It's hardly surprising that people get confused and society is going to the dogs when it's full of caffeine-free coffee, gluten-free bread, alcohol-free beer. So the bank robber who failed to be a bank robber stepped into the bank that was barely a bank and declared the purpose of the visit fairly clearly with the help of the pistol. But behind the counter sat a 20-year-old, London, deeply immersed in the sort of social media that dismantles a person's social competence to the extent that when she caught sight of the bank robber, she instinctively exclaimed, "Are you some kind of joke or what?" The fact that she didn't phrase her question as, "Is this some kind of joke?" but went straight for, "Are you a joke?" perhaps says a lot about the younger generation's lack of respect for older bank robbers. The bank robber shot her a disappointed dad look, waved the pistol, and pushed over a note which said, "This is a robbery. Give me 6,500 kroner." London's entire face frowned, and she snorted, "6,500? You haven't left off a couple of zeros? Anyway, this is a cashless bank, and are you really going to try to rob a cashless bank or what? Are you, like, totally stupid?" Somewhat taken aback, the bank robber coughed and mumbled something inaudible. London threw her arms out and asked, "Is that a real pistol? Like, a really real pistol? Because I saw a television show where a guy wasn't found guilty of armed robbery because he didn't use a real pistol." By this point in the conversation, the bank robber was starting to feel very old, especially since the 20-year-old on the other side of the conversation gave the impression that she was around 14 years old. Which, of course, she wasn't. But the bank robber was 39 and had therefore reached an age where there's suddenly very little difference between 14 and 20. That's what makes a person feel old. "Hello, are you going to answer me or what?" London exclaimed impatiently. And obviously it's easy in hindsight to think that this was a somewhat poorly considered thing to shout at a masked bank robber holding a pistol. But if you knew London, you'd have known that this wasn't because she was stupid. She was just a miserable person. That was because she didn't have any real friends, not even on social media, and instead spent most of her time getting upset that celebrities she didn't like hadn't had their life together ruined. Again. Just before the bank robber came in, she had been busy refreshing her browser to find out if two famous actors were going to get divorced or not. She hoped they were, because sometimes it's easier to live with your own anxieties if you know that no one else is happy either. The bank robber didn't say anything, though, and had started to feel rather stupid by this point, and was now regretting the whole thing. Robbing a bank had clearly been a breathtakingly stupid idea right from the outset. The bank robber was actually on the point of explaining this to London before apologizing and walking out, and then perhaps everything that happened after that wouldn't have happened at all. But the bank robber didn't get a chance, seeing as London announced instead, "Look, I'm going to call the cops now." That was when the bank robber panicked and ran out of the door. Chapter 16. Witness interview continued. "Is there anything more specific you could tell me about the perpetrator?"
"You mean the bank robber?"
"Yes."
"So why not just say that instead?"
"Is there anything more specific you could tell me about the bank robber?"
"Like what?"
"Do you remember anything about his appearance?"
"God, that's such a superficial question. You've got a really sick binary view of gender, yeah?"
"I'm sorry. Can you tell me anything else about the person?"
"You don't have to use perverted commas for that."
"I'm afraid I'm going to have to say that I do. Can you tell me anything about the bank robber's appearance? For instance, was the bank robber a short bank robber or a tall bank robber?"
"Look, I don't describe people by their height. That's really excluding. I mean, I'm short, and I know that can give a lot of tall people a complex."
"I'm sorry?"
"Tall people have feelings too, you know."
"Okay, fine. Then I can only apologize again. Let me rephrase the question. Did the bank robber look like the sort of bank robber who might have a complex?"
"Why are you rubbing your eyebrows like that? It's really creepy."
I'm sorry. What was your first impression of the bank robber?
Okay. My first impression was that the bank robber seemed to be a complete moron.
I'll interpret that as suggesting that it's perfectly okay to have a binary attitude to intelligence.
What?
Nothing. On what did you base your assumption that the bank robber was a moron?
I was handed a note saying, give me 6,500 kroner. Who the hell would rob a bank for 6,500? You rob banks to get 10 million, something like that. If all you want is 6,500 exactly, there must be some very special reason. Mustn't there?
I have to confess that I hadn't thought of it like that.
You should think more. Have you ever thought about that?
I'll do my best. Can I ask you to take a look at this sheet of paper and tell me if you recognize it?
This? Looks like a kid's drawing. And what's it supposed to be, anyway?
I think that's a monkey and a frog and a horse.
That's not a horse. That's an elk.
Do you think? All my colleagues have guessed either a horse or a giraffe.
Hang on, I just got a flash in my bud.
No, stay focused now, London. So you think this is an elk? Hello? Put your phone down and answer the question.
Yes!
Sorry?
At last! At last!
I don't understand.
They are getting divorced.
Chapter 17. The truth? The truth is that the bank robber was an adult. There's nothing more revealing about a bank robber's personality than that. Because the terrible thing about becoming an adult is being forced to realize that absolutely nobody cares about us. We have to deal with everything ourselves now, find out how the whole world works. Work and pay bills, use dental floss and get to meetings on time, stand in line and fill out forms, come to grips with cables and put furniture together, change tires on the car and charge the phone and switch the coffee machine off and not forget to sign the kids up for swimming lessons. We open our eyes in the morning and life is just waiting to tip a fresh avalanche of don't forgets and remembers over us. We don't have time to think or breathe. We just wake up and start digging through the heap because there will be another one dumped on us tomorrow. We look around occasionally at our place of work or at parents' meetings or out in the street and realize with horror that everyone else seems to know exactly what they're doing. We're the only ones who have to pretend. Everyone else can afford stuff and has a handle on other stuff and enough energy to deal with even more stuff. And everyone else's children can swim. But we weren't ready to become adults. Someone should have stopped us. The truth? The truth is that just as the bank robber ran out into the street, a police officer happened to be walking past. It would later become apparent that no police officers were yet looking for the bank robber, seeing as the alarm hadn't been raised over the radio, seeing as 20-year-old London and the staff in the emergency call center took plenty of time to become mutually offended by one another first. London reported a bank robbery, which led the call operator to ask where, which led London to give them the address of the bank, which led the call operator to ask, aren't you a cashless bank? Why would anyone want to rob that? Which led London to say, exactly, which led the call operator to ask, exactly what? Which led London to snap, what do you mean exactly what? Which led to the call operator hitting back with, you were the one who started it, which led London to yell, no, you were the one who, after which the conversation quickly deteriorated. Later, it turned out that the police officer the bank robber saw in the street wasn't actually a police officer, but a traffic warden. And if the bank robber hadn't been so stressed and had been paying attention, that would have been obvious, and a different escape strategy might have been possible, which would have made this a much shorter story. But instead, the bank robber rushed through the first available open door, which led to a stairwell, and then there weren't exactly many options except to go up the stairs. On the top floor, one of the apartment doors was wide open, so that's where the bank robber went, out of breath and sweating, with the traditional bank robber's ski mask askew so that only one eye could see anything. Only then did the bank robber notice that the hall was full of shoes and that the apartment was full of people with no shoes on. One of the women in the apartment caught sight of the pistol and started to cry, "Oh, dear Lord, we're being robbed!" And at the same time, the bank robber heard rapid footsteps out in the stairwell and assumed it was a police officer. It wasn't, it was the postman. So in the absence of other alternatives, the bank robber shut the door and aimed the pistol in various different directions at random, initially shouting, "No! No, this isn't a robbery. I just..." before quickly thinking better of it and panting, "Oh, maybe it is a robbery. But you're not the victims. It's maybe more like a hostage situation now, and I'm very sorry about that. I'm having quite a complicated day here." The bank robber undeniably had a point. Not that this is in any way a defense of bank robbers, but they can have bad days at work too. Hand on heart, which of us hasn't wanted to pull a gun after talking to a 20-year-old? A few minutes later, the street in front of the building was crawling with journalists and cameras, and after they came, the police arrived. The fact that most of the journalists arrived before the police should in no way be interpreted as evidence of their respective professions' competence, but in this instance more as proof that the police had more important things to be getting on with, and that the journalists had more time to read social media. And the unpleasant young woman in the bank that wasn't a bank was evidently able to express herself better on Twitter than over the phone. On social media, she announced that she had watched through the large front window of the bank as the robber ran into the building on the other side of the street, whereas the police didn't receive the call until the postman who had seen the bank robber in the stairwell called his wife, who happened to work in a cafe opposite the police station. She rushed across the road, and only then was the alarm sounded, to the effect that what appeared to be a man armed with what appeared to be a pistol, wearing what appeared to be a ski mask, had rushed into a viewing in one of the apartments and had locked the real estate agent and prospective buyers inside. This was how a bank robber failed to rob a bank, but instead managed to spark a hostage drama. Life doesn't always turn out the way you expect. Just as the bank robber closed the door to the apartment, a piece of paper, dislodged from a coat pocket, fluttered out into the stairwell. It was a child's drawing of a monkey, a frog, and an elk. Not a horse, and definitely not a giraffe. That was important. Because even if 20-year-olds can be wrong about a lot of things in life, and those of us who aren't 20 can probably agree that most 20-year-olds are wrong so often that most of them would have just a 1 in 4 chance of answering a yes or no question correctly, this particular 20-year-old was actually right about one thing. Normal bank robbers ask for large amounts and round figures. Anyone can go into a bank and yell, "Give me 10 million or I'll shoot." But if a person walks in armed and nervous and very specifically asks for exactly 6,500 kroner, there's probably a reason. Or two. Chapter 18. The man on the bridge 10 years ago and the bank robber who took people hostage at an apartment viewing aren't connected. They never met each other. The only thing they really have in common is moral hazard. That's a banking term, of course. Someone had to come up with it to describe the way the financial markets work, because the fact that banks are immoral is so obvious to us that simply calling them immoral wasn't enough. We needed a way to describe the fact that it's so unlikely that a bank would ever behave morally that it can only be considered a risk for them even to try. The man on the bridge gave his money to a bank so that they could make secure investments, because all investments were secure in those days. Then the man used these secure investments as security against loans, and then he took out new loans to pay off the old ones. "Everyone does this," the bank said, and the man thought, "They are the ones who should know." Then one day, all of a sudden, nothing was secure anymore. It was called a crisis in the financial markets, a bank crash, even though the only ones who crash are people. The banks are still there. The financial markets have no heart that can be broken.
But for the man on the bridge, a whole life's savings had been replaced by a mountain of debt, and no one could explain how that had happened. When the man pointed out that the bank had promised that this was entirely risk-free, the bank threw out its arms and said, "Nothing's entirely risk-free. You should have known what you were getting into. You shouldn't have given us your money." So the man went to another bank to borrow money to pay off the debts he now had because the first bank had lost all his savings. He explained to the second bank that he might lose his business otherwise, then his home, and he told them he had 2 children. The second bank nodded and was very understanding, but a woman who worked there told him, "You've suffered what we call moral hazard." The man didn't understand, so the woman explained that moral hazard is when one party in an agreement is protected against the negative consequences of its own actions. When the man still didn't understand, the woman sighed and said, "It's when 2 idiots are sitting on a creaking tree branch and the one closest to the trunk is holding the saw." The man was still blinking uncomprehendingly, so the woman raised her eyebrows and explained, "You're the idiot furthest away from the trunk. The bank's going to saw the branch off to save itself. Because the bank hasn't lost any of its own money here, just yours. Because you're the idiot who let them hold the saw." Then she calmly gathered together the man's papers, handed them back to him, and told him that she wasn't going to authorize a loan. "But it isn't my fault that they lost all my money," the man exclaimed. The woman looked at him coolly and declared, "Yes, it is. Because you shouldn't have given them your money." 10 years later, a bank robber walks into an apartment viewing. The bank robber had never had enough money to hear a woman in a bank talk about moral hazard, but the bank robber had a mother who often said that, "If you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans." And sometimes that comes down to the same thing. The bank robber was only 7 years old the first time this was said, and that may well be a little early to hear something of that nature, because it pretty much means life can go all sorts of different ways, but it will probably go wrong. Even 7-year-olds understand that. They also understand that if their mom says she doesn't like making plans, and even if she never plans to get drunk, she still ends up getting drunk a little too often for it to be a coincidence. The 7-year-old swore never to start drinking hard liquor and never to become an adult and managed to keep half that promise. And moral hazard? The 7-year-old learned about that just before Christmas Eve the same year, when Mom kneeled down on the kitchen floor and lurched into a hug that left the 7-year-old's hair peppered with cigarette ash. In a voice shaken by sobs, the 7-year-old's mom said, "Please don't be upset with me. Don't shout at me. It wasn't actually my fault." The child didn't understand exactly what that meant, but slowly began to realize that whatever it was, it might have some connection to the fact that the child had spent the past month selling Christmas editions of magazines every day after school and had given all the money to Mom so she could buy food for Christmas. The child looked into the mother's eyes. They were shiny with alcohol and tears, intoxication and self-loathing. She wept as she clung to the child. She whispered, "You shouldn't have given me the money." That was the closest the woman ever came to asking her child for forgiveness. The bank robber often thinks about that to this day. Not about how terrible it was, but about how odd it is that you can't hate your mom. That it still doesn't feel like it was her fault. They were evicted from their apartment the following February, and the bank robber swore never to become a parent. And when the bank robber ended up becoming a parent anyway, swore never to become a chaotic parent. The sort who can't cope with being an adult. The sort who can't pay bills and has nowhere to live with their kids. And God laughed. The man on the bridge wrote a letter to the woman at the bank who had told him about moral hazard. He wrote down exactly what he wanted her to hear. Then he jumped. The woman at the bank has been carrying that letter in her handbag for 10 years. Then she met the bank robber. Chapter 19. Jim and Jack were the first police officers to arrive on the scene outside the building. That wasn't so much an indication of their competence as a sign of the size of the town. There just weren't that many police officers around, especially not the day before New Year's Eve. The journalists were already there, of course. Or maybe they were just locals and curious onlookers. It can be hard to tell these days when everyone films, photographs, and documents their whole life as if every individual were their own television channel. They all looked expectantly at Jim and Jack, as if the police ought to know exactly what was going to happen next. They didn't. People simply didn't take other people hostage in this town. And people didn't rob banks here either, especially now that they'd gone cashless. "What do you think we should do?" Jack wondered.
"Me? I don't know. I really don't. You're the one who usually knows," Jim replied bluntly.
Jack looked at him despondently. "I've never been involved in a hostage drama."
"Me neither, son. But you went on that course, didn't you? That listening thing?"
"Active listening," Jack muttered. Sure enough, he'd been on the course, but precisely what use that might be to him now was hard to imagine.
"Well, didn't that teach you how to talk to hostage takers?" Jim said, nodding encouragingly.
"Sure, but in order to be able to listen, there has to be someone talking. How are we going to contact the bank robber?" Jack said, because they hadn't received any kind of message, no ransom demand, nothing. Besides, he couldn't help thinking that if the course on active listening was as good as the tutor claimed, then surely Jack ought to have a girlfriend by now.
"I don't know. I really don't," Jim admitted.
Jack sighed. "You've been in the police your whole life, Dad. You must have some experience of this sort of thing." Naturally, Jim did his best to act like he definitely had experience, seeing as dads like teaching their sons things. Because the moment we can no longer do that is when they stop being our responsibility and we become theirs. So the father cleared his throat and turned away as he took out his phone. He stood there for a good while, hoping he wasn't going to be asked what he was doing. He was, of course.
"Dad?" Jack said over his shoulder.
Jim said.
"Are you seriously Googling, what should you do in a hostage situation?" "I might be."
Jack groaned and leaned over with his palms on his knees. He was growling silently to himself because he knew what his bosses, and his bosses' bosses, would say when they called him in the very near future. The worst words Jack knew. "Perhaps we should call Stockholm and ask for help?" Sure, Jack thought, because how would it look if we actually managed to do something for ourselves in this town? He glanced up at the balcony of the apartment where the bank robber was holed up, swore under his breath. He just needed a starting point, some way of establishing contact.
"Dad,"
he eventually sighed.
"Yes, lad."
"What does it say on Google?" Jim read out loud that you have to start by finding out who the hostage taker is and what he wants. Chapter 20. Okay. A bank robber robs a bank. Think about that for a moment. Obviously, it has nothing to do with you. Just as little as a man jumping off a bridge. Because you're a normal, decent person, so you would never have robbed a bank. There are simply some things that all normal people understand that you must never, under any circumstances, do. You mustn't tell lies, you mustn't steal, you mustn't kill, and you mustn't throw stones at birds. We all agree on that. Except maybe swans, because swans can actually be passive-aggressive little bastards. But apart from swans, you mustn't throw stones at birds. And you mustn't tell lies. Unless, well, sometimes you have to, of course, like when your children ask, "Why does it smell like chocolate in here? Are you eating chocolate?" But you definitely mustn't steal or kill. We can agree on that. Well, you mustn't kill people, anyway. And most of the time, you mustn't even kill swans, even if they are bastards. But you're allowed to kill animals if they've got horns and are standing in the forest,
or if they're bacon. But you must never kill people. Well, unless they're Hitler. You're allowed to kill Hitler if you've got a time machine and an opportunity to do it, because you must be allowed to kill one person to save several million others and avoid a world war. Anyone can understand that. But how many people do you have to save in order to be allowed to kill someone? 1 million? 150? Two? Just one? None at all? Obviously, you won't have an exact answer to that, because no one does. Let's take a much simpler example then. Are you allowed to steal? No, you mustn't steal. We agree on that. Except when you steal someone's heart, because that's romantic. Or if you steal harmonicas from guys who play the harmonica at parties, because that's being public-spirited. Or if you steal something small, because you really have to. That's probably okay. But does that mean it's okay to steal something a bit bigger? And who decides how much bigger? If you really have to steal, how much do you have to do it in order for it to be reasonable to steal something really serious? For instance, if you feel that you really have to and that no one will get hurt, is it okay to rob a bank then? No, it probably isn't really okay, even then. You're probably right about that. Because you'd never rob a bank, so you haven't got anything in common with this bank robber. Except fear, possibly. Because maybe you've been really frightened at some time, and so was the bank robber. Possibly because the bank robber had small children and had therefore had a lot of practice being afraid. Perhaps you, too, have children, in which case you'll know that you're frightened the whole time. Frightened of not knowing everything, and of not having the energy to do everything, and of not coping with everything. In the end, we actually get so used to the feeling of failure that every time we don't disappoint our children, it leaves us feeling secretly shocked. It's possible that some children realize this. So every so often, they do tiny, tiny things at the most peculiar times to buoy us up a little, just enough to stop us from drowning. So the bank robber left home one morning with that drawing of the frog, the monkey, and the elk tucked away in a pocket without realizing it. The girl who had drawn it put it there. The little girl has an older sister. They ought to fight the way sisters are always said to do, but they hardly ever do that. The younger one is allowed to play in the older sister's room without the older one yelling at her. The older one gets to keep the things she cares for most without the younger one breaking them on purpose. Their parents used to whisper, "We don't deserve them," when the girls were very small. They were right. Now, after the divorce, during the weeks when the girls live with one of their parents, they listen to the news in the car in the morning. Their other parent is in the news today, but they don't know that yet. They don't know that one of their parents has become a bank robber. During the weeks when the girls live with their bank robber parent, they go on the bus. They love that. All the way, they invent little stories about the strangers in the seats at the front. "That man there, he could be a fireman," their parent whispers. "And she might be an alien," the youngest daughter says. Then it's the older daughter's turn, and she says really loudly, "That one could be a wanted man who's killed someone and has their head in his backpack. Who knows?" Then the women in the seats around them shuffle uncomfortably, and the daughters giggle so hard that they almost can't breathe, and their parent has to put on a serious face and pretend that it really isn't funny at all. They're almost always late to the bus stop, and as they run across the bridge and the bus stops on the other side, the girls always shriek with laughter, "The elk's coming! The elk's coming!" Because their bank robber parents' legs are very long, out of proportion, and that means you look funny when you run. No one noticed that before the girls appeared, but children notice people's proportions in a different way from adults, possibly because they always see us from below, and that's our worst angle. That's why they make such good bullies, the quick-witted little monsters. They have access to everything that's most vulnerable in us. Even so, they forgive us, the whole time, for almost everything. And that's the weirdest thing about being someone's parent. Not just a bank robber parent, but any parent. That you are loved in spite of everything that you are.
Even astonishingly late in life, people seem incapable of considering that their parents might not be super smart and really funny and immortal. Perhaps there's a biological reason for that, that up to a certain age, a child loves you unconditionally and hopelessly for one single reason. You're theirs. Which is a pretty smart move on biology's part. You have to give it that. The bank robber parent never uses the girl's real names. That's the sort of thing you never really notice until you belong to someone else. The fact that those of us who give children their names are the least willing to use them. We give those we love nicknames, because love requires a word that belongs to us alone. So the bank robber parent always calls the girls what they used to feel like, kicking in their mother's belly 6 and 8 years ago. One of them always seemed to be jumping about in there, and the other always seemed to be climbing. One frog, one monkey, and an elk that would do anything for them, even when it's completely stupid. Perhaps you have that in common after all. You probably have someone in your life whom you'd do something stupid for. But obviously, you would still never rob a bank. Of course not. But perhaps, though, you've been in love. Almost everyone has, after all. And love can make you do quite a lot of ridiculous things. Getting married, for instance. Having children, playing happy families, and having a happy marriage. Or you might think that, anyway. Not happy, perhaps, but plausible. A plausible marriage. Because how happy can anyone really be all the time? How could there be time for that? Mostly we're just trying to get through the day. You've probably had days like that as well. But when you get through enough of them, one morning you look over your shoulder and realize that you're on your own. The person you were married to turned off somewhere along the way. Maybe you uncover a lie. That's what happened to the bank robber. An infidelity comes to light. And even if no one's actually been unfaithful to you, you can probably appreciate that it's enough to knock a person off balance. Especially if it wasn't just a fling, but an affair that had been going on for a long time. You haven't only been cheated on, you've also been deceived. It's possible for someone to be unfaithful to you without really thinking about you at all, but an affair requires planning. Perhaps that's what hurts most of all, the millions of tiny clues that you didn't notice. Maybe you'd have been even more crushed if there wasn't even a good explanation. For instance, maybe you could have understood if it was about loneliness or desire. You're always at work and we never have any time for each other. But if the explanation is, if you want me to be really honest, the person I've been unfaithful with is your boss, then it can be harder to get back up again. Because that means that the reason you've been working so much overtime is also the same reason why you no longer have a marriage. When you get to work on the Monday after the breakup, your boss says, obviously it's going to be uncomfortable for everyone involved, so perhaps it would be easiest if you no longer worked here. On Friday, you were married and had a job, and on Monday, you're homeless and unemployed. What do you do then? Talk to a solicitor? Sue someone? No. Because the bank robber was told, don't make a scene now, don't cause chaos for the children's sake. So the bank robber didn't. Didn't want to be that sort of parent. So just moved out of the apartment, left work, eyes closed, jaw clenched. For the children's sake. Perhaps you'd have done the same. Once the frog said she'd heard an adult on the bus say, love hurts. And the monkey replied that maybe that's why hearts end up jagged when you try to draw them. How do you explain a divorce to them after that? How do you explain about infidelity? How do you avoid turning them into little cynics? Falling in love is magical, after all, romantic, breathtaking. But falling in love and love are different, aren't they? Don't they have to be? Good grief, no one could cope with being newly infatuated year after year. When you're infatuated, you can't think about anything else. You forget about your friends, your work, your lunch. If we were infatuated all the time, we'd starve to death. And being in love means being infatuated. From time to time, You have to be sensible. The problem is that everything is relative. Happiness is based on expectations, and we have the internet now. A whole world constantly asking us, but is your life as perfect as this? Well, how about now? Is it as perfect as this? If it isn't, change it. The truth, of course, is that if people really were as happy as they look on the internet, they wouldn't spend so much damn time on the internet. Because no one who's having a really good day spends half of it taking pictures of themselves. Anyone can nurture a myth about their life if they have enough manure. So if the grass looks greener on the other side of the fence, that's probably because it's full of shit. Not that that really makes much difference, because now we've learned that every day needs to be special. Every day. Suddenly you find yourselves living alongside each other, not with each other. One of us can go around for a shocking length of time thinking our marriage is good, or at least no worse than anyone else's. Plausible, anyway. Then it turns out that one of us wants more. Just getting through the day isn't enough. One of us worked and went home, worked and went home, worked and went home, trying to be amenable in both places. And then it turns out that the person you were married to and the person you are working for have been extremely amenable to each other the whole time. Love one another until death do us part. Isn't that what we said? Isn't that what we promised each other? Or am I remembering wrong? Or at least until one of us gets bored. Maybe that was it? Now the monkey and the frog and one parent and the boss live in the apartment, and the bank robber parent lives somewhere else. Because the apartment was only in the name of the other parent, and the bank robber parent didn't want to make a fuss, not cause chaos. But it isn't exactly easy to get a home in this part of town, or any other part of any other town, really, if you haven't got a job or any savings. You don't put your name on the list for public housing when you're married and have children and a life because it never occurs to you that you might lose all of it in the course of an afternoon. The worst thing a divorce does to a person isn't that it makes all the time you devoted to the relationship feel wasted, but that it steals all the plans you had for the future. Buying an apartment is completely out of the question, the bank said, because who'd lend money to someone without money? You only lend money to people who don't really need to borrow money. So where are you to live, you might ask. You'll have to rent, the bank said. But in order to rent an apartment in this town when you don't have a job, you have to put down 4 months' rent as a deposit you get back when you move out, for all the good it'll do you then. Then a letter arrived from a lawyer. It said that the monkey and frog's other parent had decided to apply for sole custody of the children because the current situation, in which their other custodian has neither a home nor a job, is untenable. We really must think of the children. As if there were anything else a parent with no home and no job ever thinks about. The other parent also sent an email saying, "You need to pick up your things." Which means, of course, that you have to pick up the things that the other parent and your old boss, after pinching all the good stuff, have decided are rubbish. They're packed away in the storeroom in the basement. So what do? Maybe you go there late one evening to avoid the shame of bumping into any of the neighbors, and maybe you realize you've got nowhere to take the things. You haven't got anywhere to live, and it's starting to get cold outside, so you stay in the storeroom in the basement. In another storeroom, belonging to a neighbor who's forgotten to lock up, is a box full of blankets. You borrow them to keep yourself warm. For some reason, beneath the blankets is a toy pistol. So you sleep with that in your hand, thinking that if some crazy burglar breaks in during the night, you can scare them away with it. Then you start to cry, because you realize that you're the crazy burglar. The next morning you put the blankets back but keep the toy pistol because you don't know where you're going to sleep that night and it might come in useful. This goes on for a week. You might not know exactly how it feels, but perhaps you've also had moments when you stare at yourself in the mirror and think,
this wasn't how life was supposed to turn out. That can terrify a person. So one morning you do something desperate. Well, not you, obviously. You'd have done something different, of course. You'd have found out about the law and what your rights were, and you'd have gotten hold of a lawyer and gone to court. Unless perhaps you wouldn't have done that. Because perhaps you didn't want to make a fuss in front of your daughters. You didn't want to be one of those chaotic parents. So maybe you'd have thought, somehow, if I get the chance, I'll find a way to sort this out without upsetting them. So when a small apartment becomes available, fairly close to the apartment where the monkey and the frog live, right by the bridge, a sublet from someone already subletting from someone else subletting, at a cost of $6,500 a month, you think, if I can just manage a month, I'll have time to find a job. Then they won't be able to take the children away from me, as long as I just have somewhere to live. So you empty your bank account and sell everything you own and scrape together enough money for a month, and you lie awake 30 nights in a row, wondering how you're going to afford another month. And then suddenly you can't. You're supposed to go to the authorities in that situation. That's what you're supposed to do. But perhaps you stand outside the door and think about your mom and what the air in there was like when you sat on a wooden bench with a numbered ticket between your fingertips. You remember how much a child can lie for their parents' sake. You can't force your heart to cross the threshold. The stupidest thing people who have everything think about people who have nothing is that it's pride that stops a person from asking for help. That's very rarely the case. Addicts are good at lying, but never as good as their children. It's their sons and daughters who have to come up with excuses. Never too outlandish or incredible, always mundane enough for no one to want to check them. An addict's child's homework never gets eaten by the dog. They just forgot their backpack at home. Their mom didn't miss parents' evening because she was kidnapped by ninjas, but because she had to work overtime. The child doesn't remember the name of the place she's working. It's only a temporary job. She does her best, mom does, to support us now that dad's gone, you know. You soon learn how to phrase things in such a way as to preclude any follow-up questions. You learn that the women in the welfare office can take you away from her if they find out she managed to set fire to your last apartment when she fell asleep with a cigarette in her hand, or if they find out she stole the Christmas ham from the supermarket. So you lie when the security guard comes, you take the ham off her, and confess, "It was me who took it." No one calls the police for a child, not when it's Christmas. So they let you go home with your mom, hungry, but not alone. If you had been that sort of child, and then grown up and had children of your own, you would never have subjected them to that. Under no circumstances would they have to learn to become such good liars. You would promise yourself that. So you don't go to the welfare office because you're scared they'll take the girls away from you. You accept the divorce and don't put up a fight for your apartment or your job because you don't want the girls to have parents who are at war with each other. You try to sort everything out yourself, and eventually you get a stroke of luck. You manage to find a job against the odds, not the sort you can live comfortably on, but one you can survive on for a while. That's all you need, a chance. But they tell you your first month's wages are being withheld, meaning that they won't pay you for the first month until you've worked 2 months, as if the first month weren't the time when you can least afford to go without money. You go to the bank and ask for a loan so that you can afford to work for no wages, but the bank tells you that isn't possible because it isn't a permanent job. You could get fired at any time. And then how would they get their money back? Because you haven't got any, have you? You try to explain that if you had money, you wouldn't need a loan, but the bank can't see the logic in that. So what do? You struggle on. Hope that'll be enough. Then you receive another threatening letter from the lawyer. You don't know what to do, who to turn to. You just don't want to start a fight. You run to the bus in the morning. Imagine that the girls can't see how you're feeling, but they do. You can see in their eyes that they want to sell subscriptions to magazines and give you all the money. When you leave them at school, you go into an alleyway and sit down on the edge of the sidewalk and cry because you can't stop thinking, "You shouldn't have loved me." All your life, you've promised yourself that you'll cope with everything, not be a chaotic person, not have to beg for help. But Christmas Eve arrives, and you suffer your way through it in lonely despair because the girls are going to spend New Year's Day with you. The day before New Year's Eve, you put the latest letter from the lawyer who wants to take them away from you in your pocket, next to the letter from your landlord, which says that if you don't pay the rent today, you're going to be evicted. Right there, right then, it takes next to nothing to knock you off balance. One really bad idea is enough. You find the toy pistol that looks like a real pistol. You make holes in a black woolly hat and pull it down over your face. You go into the bank that wasn't prepared to lend you any money because you didn't have any money. You tell yourself that you're only going to ask for 6,500 kroner for the rent and that you'll return it as soon as you get paid. How, a more ordered mind might be asking, but, well, perhaps you haven't really thought that far ahead. Perhaps you just think you'll go back in the same ski mask and with the same pistol and force them to take the money back? Because all you need is 1 month. All you need is one single chance to sort everything out. Later, it turns out that that damn toy pistol, the one that looked almost real, looked real because it was real. And in a stairwell, a drawing of an elk and a frog and a monkey flutters on the breeze. And in an apartment at the top of the building is a rug soaked in blood. This wasn't how life was supposed to turn out. Chapter 21. It wasn't a bomb. It was a box of Christmas lights that one of the neighbors had strung up on his balcony. He had actually been thinking of leaving them up over New Year's Day, but then he had a row with his wife because she thought, "There are far too many lights, don't you think? And why can't we have ordinary white lights like everyone else? Do we have to have flashing lights, all different colors, so it looks like we've opened a brothel?" He had muttered back, "What sort of brothels have you been to if they have flashing lights?" And then she had raised her eyebrows and suddenly demanded to know, "What sort of brothels have you been to, seeing as you know exactly what they look like?" And the row had ended with him going out onto the balcony and pulling the damn lights down. But he couldn't be bothered to carry the box down to the storeroom in the basement, so he left them on the landing outside the door to their apartment. Then he and his wife went off to her parents to celebrate the new year and argue about brothels. The box was left outside the door, on the floor below the apartment that ended up being the location for a hostage drama. When the postman at the start of this story came up the stairs and suddenly caught sight of the armed bank robber going into the apartment that was open for viewing, obviously he couldn't get downstairs fast enough and stumbled over the box, accidentally dislodging the wires from the top of it. It didn't look like a bomb. It really didn't. It looked like an overturned box of Christmas lights. From a brothel. But in Jim's defense, perhaps it looked like it could have been a bomb, especially if you'd mostly only heard about bombs but never actually seen one. Or a brothel. Rather like if you're really frightened of snakes and are sitting on the toilet and feel a slight draft on your backside, and you automatically think, "Snake!" Obviously, that's neither logical nor plausible, but if phobias were logical and plausible, they wouldn't be called phobias. Jim was considerably more frightened of bombs than he was of Christmas lights, and at times like that, your brain and eyes can have a bit of a falling out. That's the point here. So the two police officers had been standing down in the street. Jim had looked for advice on Google, and Jack had phoned the owner of the apartment where the hostages were to find out roughly how many people might be in there. The owner turned out to be a mother with a young family in a different town altogether. She said the apartment had been passed down to her and that she hadn't been there in person for a very long time. She didn't have anything to say about the viewing. "The real estate agent's in charge of all that," she said. Then Jack called the police station and spoke to the woman at the cafe, who was married to the postman who first raised the alarm about the bank robber. Unfortunately, Jack didn't find out very much more, except for the fact that the bank robber was masked and fairly small. Not really small, but normally small. Maybe more normal than small. But what's normal?
Jack tried to come up with a plan based on this scant information, but didn't get very far because his boss called, and when Jack couldn't immediately present him with a plan, the boss called the boss's boss and the boss's boss's boss, and all the bosses naturally agreed, predictably enough, that it would probably be best if they called Stockholm at once. All of them apart from Jack, of course, who wanted to deal with something himself for once in his life. He suggested that the bosses should let him and Jim go into the stairwell and up to the apartment to see if they could make contact with the bank robber. The bosses agreed to this, despite their doubts, because Jack was basically the sort of police officer that other police officers trusted. But Jim was standing beside him and heard as one of the bosses shouted down the line that they should take it really damn carefully and make sure there are no explosives or other crap in the stairwell because it might not be about the hostages. It could be a terrorist incident. Have you seen anyone carrying any suspicious packages? Anyone with a beard? Jack wasn't bothered by any of that because he was young, but Jim was seriously bothered because he was someone's father. The elevator was out of order, so he and Jack took the stairs, and on the way up, they knocked on all the doors to see if any of the neighbors were still in the building. No one was home, because the day before New Year's Eve, anyone who had to work was at work, and anyone who didn't have to work had better things to do. And anyone who didn't must have heard the sirens and seen the reporters and police officers from their balconies and gone outside to see what was going on. Some of them were actually afraid that there was a snake loose in the building, because there'd recently been rumors on the internet that a snake had been found in a toilet in a block of apartments in the neighboring town, so that was pretty much the level of probability for hostage dramas in those parts. When Jack and Jim reached the floor with the box and the wires, Jim started so hard with fear that he hurt his back. Here it should be noted that Jim had recently hurt his back in the same place when he happened to sneeze unexpectedly, but still. He yanked Jack back and hissed, "Bomb!" Jack rolled his eyes the way only sons can and said, "That isn't a bomb." "How do you know that?" Jim wondered. "Bombs don't look like that," Jack said. "Maybe that's what whoever made the bomb wants you to think." "Dad, pull yourself together. That isn't..." If it had been any other colleague, Jim would probably have let him carry on up the stairs. Maybe that's why some people think it's a bad idea for fathers and sons to work together. Because Jim said instead, "No, I'm going to call Stockholm." Jack never forgave him for that. The bosses and the bosses' bosses and whoever was above them in the hierarchy who issued orders immediately issued an order that the two officers should go back down to the street and wait for backup. Obviously, it wasn't easy to find backup, even in the big cities, because who the hell robs a bank the day before New Year's Eve? And who the hell takes people hostage at an apartment viewing? And who the hell has an apartment viewing the day before, as one of the bosses wondered. And they carried on like that for a good while over the radio. Then a specialist negotiator from Stockholm called Jack's phone to say that he was going to be taking charge of the entire operation. He was currently in a car several hours away, but Jack needed to understand very clearly that he was expected merely to contain the situation until the negotiator arrived. The negotiator spoke with an accent that definitely wasn't from Stockholm, but that didn't matter, because if you asked Jim and Jack, being a Stockholmer was more a state of mind than a description of geographic origin. Not all idiots are Stockholmers, but all Stockholmers are idiots, as people often said at the police station, which was obviously extremely unfair, because it's possible to stop being an idiot, but you can't stop being a Stockholmer. After talking to the negotiator, Jack was even angrier than he'd been the last time he'd had to speak to a customer service representative at his internet provider. Jim, in turn, felt the weight of responsibility for the fact that his son wasn't now going to get the chance to show that he could apprehend the bank robber on his own. All their decisions for the remainder of the day would come to be governed by those feelings.
"Sorry, son, I didn't mean..." Jim began sheepishly,
without knowing how he was going to finish the sentence, without admitting that if Jack had been any other man's son, Jim would most likely have agreed that it wasn't a bomb. But you don't take any risks if the son is your own son.
"Not now, Dad,"
Jack replied sullenly, because he was talking to their boss's boss on the phone again.
"What do you want me to do?" Jim asked, because he needed to be needed. You can start by trying to get hold of people living in the neighboring apartments, the ones we never reached because of you and your bomb, so we know that the rest of the building is empty, Jack snapped.
Jim nodded, crushed. He looked up the phone numbers on Google. First, the owner of the apartment on the floor where Jim had seen the bomb. A man replied, said he and his wife were away, and when his wife snapped, "Who's that?" irritably in the background, the man snapped back, "It's the brothel." Jim didn't know what that was supposed to mean, so he asked instead if there was anyone in their apartment. When the man said there wasn't, Jim didn't want to worry him by talking about the bomb, and there was no way the man could possibly have known at that point that if he had just said, "By the way, that box on the landing contains Christmas lights," then this whole story would have changed instantly. So the man merely asked instead, "Was there anything else?" And Jim said, no, I think that's everything," then thanked him and hung up. Then he called the owners of the apartment at the top of the building, the one on the same floor as the apartment where the hostage drama was going on. The owners of that one turned out to be a young couple in their early 20s. They were in the middle of splitting up and had both moved out.
"So the apartment's empty?" Jim asked, relieved.
It was, but in two separate conversations, Jim still had to listen as two 20-somethings took it for granted that Jim would want to know why they had split up. It turned out that one of them couldn't live with the fact that the other one had such ugly shoes, and the other was turned off by the fact that the first dribbled when he brushed his teeth, and that both of them would rather have a partner who wasn't quite so short. One said that the relationship was doomed because the other liked coriander, so Jim said, "And you don't?" only to receive the reply, "I do, but not as much as her." The other one said they'd started to hate each other after an argument that, as far as Jim could understand, started when they were unable to find a juicer in a color that reflected them both as individuals, but also as a couple. That was when they realized that they couldn't live together another minute longer, and now they hated each other. It struck Jim that today's youngsters had far too much choice. That was the whole problem. If all those modern dating apps had existed when Jim's wife first met him, she would never have ended up becoming his wife. If you're constantly presented with alternatives, you can never make up your mind, Jim thought. How could anyone live with the stress of knowing that while their partner was in the bathroom, they could be swiping right or left and finding their soulmate? A whole generation would end up getting urinary tract infections because they had to keep waiting to pee until the charge on their partner's phone ran out. But obviously, Jim said none of this, merely asked one last time,
"So the apartment's empty?"
They each confirmed that it was. All that was left in there was a juicer in the wrong color. The apartment was going to be put up for sale in the new year with an estate agency whose name one of them couldn't remember, only that it was really corny, kind of dad joke corny. The other one confirmed this. "Whoever named that estate agency has a worse sense of humor than hairdressers. Did you know there's one here called The Uppercut? I mean, like, what?" Jim hung up then. He thought it was a shame that they'd split up, those two, because they deserved each other. He went over to Jack and tried to tell him about it, but Jack just said, "Not now, Dad. Did you get hold of the neighbors?" Jim nodded. "Is anyone home?" Jack asked. Jim shook his head.
"I just wanted to say that," he began,
but Jack shook his head and resumed his conversation with his boss.
"Not now, Dad."
So Jim didn't say anything more. What then? Well, then everything slid out of control, little by little. The whole hostage drama took several hours, but the negotiator got caught up in traffic and ended up stuck behind the worst multi-vehicle pileup of the year on the motorway.
"Bound to be Stockholmers who set out without proper studded tires," Jim declared confidently.
So he never arrived. Jim and Jack were left to deal with the situation themselves, which wasn't without its complications, seeing as it took them a long time before they even managed to establish contact with the bank robber, culminating in Jack getting a large bump on his head, which itself is quite a long story. But eventually they managed to get a phone inside the apartment, which is an even longer story. And once the bank robber had released all the hostages and the negotiator made a call to that phone, that was when the pistol shot was heard from inside the apartment. Several hours later, Jack and Jim were still sitting in the police station interviewing all the witnesses. That didn't help at all, of course, because at least one of them wasn't telling the truth. Chapter 22. The truth is that the bank robber went to ridiculous lengths not to point the pistol at anyone inside the apartment, to avoid frightening anyone. But the first person the bank robber accidentally happened to aim the pistol at was a woman called Zara. She's somewhere in her 50s, and beautifully dressed in that way that people who have become financially independent on the back of other people's financial dependency often are. The funny thing is that when the bank robber rushed in, stumbled, and ended up waving the pistol in such a way that Zara found herself staring straight down the barrel of the gun, she didn't even look scared. Another woman in the apartment, on the other hand, let out a shriek of panic. "Oh, dear Lord, we're being robbed!" Which seemed a little odd, because the bank robber had absolutely no intention that this bit should be a robbery. Obviously, no one likes being treated in a prejudiced way. And the fact that you just happen to be holding a pistol doesn't automatically make you a robber. And even if you are, you can still be a bank robber without necessarily wanting to rob individuals. So when another woman cried, "Get your money out, Roger," to her husband, the bank robber couldn't help feeling rather insulted. Not unreasonably, really. Then a middle-aged man in a checkered shirt who was standing by the window, Roger, evidently, muttered sullenly, "We haven't got any cash." The bank robber was about to protest, but caught sight of the reflection captured in the balcony window. A figure with a masked face armed with a pistol, and the other people in the room. One of them was a very old woman. Another was pregnant. A third looked like she was about to burst into tears. They were all staring at the pistol, eyes wild with fear. No one's wilder than the eyes staring out through the holes in the ski mask in the reflection. Then the bank robber reached a crushing realization. They're not the captives here. I am. The only person who didn't look remotely scared was Zara. That's when they heard the sound of the first police sirens from down in the street. Chapter 23.
Witness interview, date December 30th. Name of witness, Zara. "Hello, my name's Jim."
"Yes, yes, fine. Get on with it."
"So I'm here to record your version of what happened. Tell me about it in your own words."
"Who else's words would I use?"
"Well, yes, quite. Just a figure of speech, I suppose. But first I'd like to make you aware that everything you say here is being recorded, and you can have a lawyer present if you'd like one."
"Why would I want one?"
"I just want you to be aware of that. My bosses say that their bosses say it's important that everything's done properly. We're going to be getting a team of special investigators from Stockholm. We're going to take over this investigation. My son's very angry about that. He's also a police officer, you see. So I just wanted to let you know that bit about having a lawyer present."
"Listen, I'll pay for a lawyer if I ever threaten anyone with a pistol. Not when I'm the one being threatened."
"I understand. I certainly didn't mean to be impertinent. Certainly not. I realize you've had a difficult day. Obviously, I realize that. You just need to answer all my questions as honestly as you can. Would you like coffee?"
"Is that what you call it? I saw what came out of that machine out there, and I wouldn't drink that if you and I were the last people on the planet and you promised me it was poison."
"I'm not sure if that's more of an insult to me or the coffee."
"You said you wanted me to answer your questions honestly."
"Yes, I suppose I did, didn't I? Well, can I start by asking why you were in the apartment?"
"What a stupid question. Were you the one standing in the stairwell when we were released?"
"Yes, that was me."
"So you were the first one into the apartment after we left, and you still managed to lose the bank robber?"
"I wasn't actually first in. I waited for Jack, my colleague. You probably met him earlier. He was the first man into the apartment."
"You policemen all look alike. Did you know that?"
"Jack's my son. Maybe that's why."
"Jim and Jack?"
"Yes, like Jim Beam and Jack Daniels."
"Is that supposed to be funny?"
"No, no. My wife's never found that funny either.
So you're married, then?
Well done, you.
Yes, perhaps that isn't entirely relevant right now. Can you give me a short explanation of why you were at the viewing of the apartment?
It was an apartment viewing. Is that phrase too hard to understand?
So you were there to look at the apartment?
You're about as sharp as a wet box of cornflakes, aren't you?
Does that mean yes?
It means what it means.
What I mean is, were you planning to buy the apartment?
Are you a real estate agent or a policeman?
I just mean that it would be easy to assume that you might be a little too well off to be interested in that apartment.
Oh, it would it?
Well, what I mean is that my colleagues and I might think that. One of them, anyway. My son, I mean. Based on some of the witness statements, I mean. You seem comfortably off, that's what I mean. And at first glance, this apartment doesn't look like the sort of thing that someone like you would want to buy.